This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to be the Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at why the Texas freeze exposed some fragility in power grids and balance sheets.
Plus, what travel recovery looks like in Europe.
But first, we want to begin with a look at inflation and why it's difficult to talk about markets given so much recent volatility and plus the movements, particularly in yields. From where we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rates Strategist Ira Jersey. Ira, always good to talk to you. Have we seen the top in yields? How high can we go? What can we take?
Well, I think the answer to the whether or not yields are done going up, I think the answer is no. I do think that as expectations for economic recovery continue to improve, that you're going to see yields continue to move higher and higher. And, of course, there's also the specter of additional supply potentially. So issuing more and more treasuries over the next couple of years in order to fund potentially a $1.9 trillion fiscal stimulus package, plus on top of that, a longer-term infrastructure package that's being discussed now, too. So between a better economic conditions in general as well as additional supply, I think you have to think about, you know, Treasury yields continuing to go up, and in particular in the longer end of the yield curve. So the 10-year, the 30-year, for example, those yields continuing to move higher because the front end is not going to move very much at all, like the 2-year note, just because the Fed's going to be on hold probably through 2022, if not further.
Yeah, that's kind of where I wanted to go, Ira. You know, we did hear from the Fed Chairman Jay Powell this week that it seems like lower for longer is still the rule there. What's the risk, I guess, of the market getting maybe in front of the Fed and kind of dictating, no, we think rates are going up?
Yeah, so it's been noted that, you know, there's been times recently where we were originally pricing for a hike in late 2023, then it was early 2023, and then there were times, you know, where you look at some of the 2022 instruments, and those seem to be pricing in some chance of a hike at this point. I think that all of that is too early, and this is not dissimilar to what happened in 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015. You get my point here, right, Paul, that it took a very long time. The market kept pricing for a hike next year, and then next year, and then next year. And it was 5 years before we ultimately got that first hike in December of 2015. So I think that the market is always going to be pricing in some kind of risk premia, but it is likely, I think, not to be correct in those earlier hikes in particular. You know, could we see a hike late 2023? I can convince myself that there is a scenario that could occur, but I think that's probably the earliest. So I think that the market is being a little bit too optimistic about what the Fed might do in late 2022 and early 2023.
Well, it's interesting because there's been a lot of conversation about the reaction function of the market and trying to like force the Fed's hand. So you see potentially the market pricing in something, and then at some point they can't price it in anymore, and then we kind of see a different re-rating in the bond market?
Well, I think at this point, Alex, I think it's all about inflation. Because, mm-hmm. And Jay Powell said that before the Senate, where he was looking at, look, he said, regardless of what happens with employment, employment could be near full employment. If we don't see inflation above 2% for some period of time, and Richard Clarida earlier this year back in January mentioned he thinks that that's at least a year, that you have to have inflation above 2%, that they're not going to hike. So they're going to take their dual mandate to kind of the nth degree at this point and really be concerned that they want inflation to be higher and they want good inflation to be higher. And what is good inflation? Good inflation means wages are growing, and wages are pushing retail sales higher, and that's what's causing inflation. And we are years away from that, quite frankly. We've done a lot of work on this, myself and my associate Angelo Montalato, those. We've really dug into CPI, to wages, to all of the drivers of that. And what you have to see, and the underlying factor is, in the United States, what drives inflation and sustained inflation is inflation. It doesn't, is wages. So if wages aren't rising, you're not going to have inflation that's going to be sustainable. Full stop. It doesn't matter what's going on with goods out of China. It doesn't matter what's going on with the dollar. It doesn't matter what's going on with grain prices. It's all about wages in the longer term. And that's, I think, what the Fed's going to be focused on, and that's where they really want to see that kind of wage inflation push. And eventually they'll hike into that, but they've made it very clear that they intend to wait until inflation is generated. So you're still talking about years of zero interest rates for now.
Well, that's kind of where I wanted to go, Ira. You know, we're hearing, you know, when you look at the pandemic metrics, they're getting better and better. When you listen to economists, they're jacking up their GDP forecast. You know, we had great retail sales. We had better industrial production recently. So if we do get to a 3, 4, 5% GDP economy coming out on the other side of this, where's the 10-year in that kind of environment?
Yeah, so I think we could break 2% in 2022. I don't think that's an unreasonable expectation. And quite frankly, Paul, it all comes from real yield. So you have two components when you think about what a bond yield is. The first is inflation and inflation expectation. So that's what we call your inflation break even. And the other is real yield. So that's how much risk premium the market wants to take in order to buy a treasury security.
That's such a good point, and also helps sort of the asset price bubble thing. Okay, Ira, thanks a lot. Super appreciate it. Ira Jersey, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist.
Coming up on the program, snow in Texas, just another part of 2021. A look at what the snowfall has exposed in terms of infrastructure.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Our next guest points out the recent Texas freeze exposed a myriad of power grid issues. For more, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Fernando Valle. Fernando, a tough couple of weeks for our good friends down in Texas, and that includes the power grid, and the whole energy complex. What's your takeaway?
Well, Paul, I think the biggest one is that we didn't learn our lessons from 2011 when Texas went through exactly the same thing, and we need to put a lot more effort into our infrastructure, specifically the power grid, as we continue our energy transition and the demand on electric utilities.
Do you think that the fight about when caused this or when didn't cause this, is that still going to be the main takeaway because I feel like if we stay there, there's no way to look at the broader issues. And the broader issues seem to be that we need all different types of energy for the energy transition. You need to beef up your grids. You need to winterize your grids and your power sources, and you need to have battery storage.
Well, exactly. I think there's no question in my mind that wind and solar didn't cause this. They didn't help it, but they didn't cause it. What caused it was a lack of investment in weatherizing our systems, a lack of investment in storage, not just battery, but even natural gas storage, a lack of investment in redundancy, essentially. Texas is its own energy island. It can import from Mexico. It can import natural gas from Oklahoma and neighboring states. But all of that becomes much more difficult in these times of extreme needs. And as we see weather patterns change and become these events happen more often, we need to take precautions because there are lives at stake, both in Texas and in California when the wildfire hits. So we need to really make moves, as you mentioned, to create a basket approach that includes several different types of energy and redundancy so that we have the capacity to maintain at least critical electricity and heating for families in need during these extreme events.
So, Fernando, I guess the big issue here is, you know, if you want to winterize your energy infrastructure in places like Texas, it comes down to dollars and cents and what's the return on that investment. It seems like now these things are becoming more common, and the argument might be for, all right, it's time to really step up.
Yeah, well, absolutely. In 2011, when the same exact event happened, the findings were we needed to weatherize the system because these events would happen once every 10 years. And just right on the clock, it happened again in Texas, and we hadn't made those investments. But just as we are investing, making our energy more efficient and greener, we also need to increase the redundancy because it is literally a matter of life and death for families in Texas as it was in California, and we need to do it to prevent bigger events from happening. And this is not just families that lose power, but they can also lead to bigger events from catastrophic failure for important utilities to other critical infrastructure in our that depends on our grid. And as we increase the reliance on electricity with electric vehicles and others, it will become even more important, and that cost will make a lot more sense in the next few years.
So to just kind of double down on that question, because the way I understand it is that the unregulated market in Texas was supposed to do that. So in theory, utilities were going to be making so much money during high demand periods and not as much during low demand periods, but the high demand periods were going to be enough incentive to use that money to then reinvest it. It's that last part that didn't happen. So I guess the question is, does it have to come from companies? Is it going to be the feds? Does it have to come from Texas? Like, I really find it difficult to think that Texas is going to be like, all right, let's go regulate it and see what happens, because that's what we do in the Northeast, and that's why we're protected against these kind of situations.
Well, I think you can do both. I think there is a little bit of regulation, which is essentially saying me as the state of Texas are going to give you the utilities an underlying baseload payment so that you keep a certain amount of capacity available for crises. And we increase that payment, basically standing charges, so that it is available at least for critical infrastructure. That will raise the cost, but think of it as essentially insurance for our grid. And that is what Texas should do. And it doesn't mean regulating the peak pricing or capacity. It's just saying, I'm going to give you a baseline where I'll pay you to keep that available in case anything happens. We have that baseline to cover any emergencies.
All right. How about winterizing, you know, some of these energy facilities here? Again, who initiates that? Because it doesn't appear like it's going to be the companies themselves. What's the regulatory oversight from that perspective?
Well, that's what happens if you give them a standing charge and you say this needs to be available. So okay, make these investments, because if you don't and it's not available, then I can charge you, and I'm basically giving you the incentives for you to make it available during the harshest winter conditions.
Then in the nitty gritty, in terms of like what's on the ground, what's the state of oil production and refining capacity? Because I keep reading that oil production is going to be fine, it'll come back a couple weeks, but some refineries could be out for a while. What's kind of the problem there, and is there any feedback loop? Because then there's obviously going to be a product shortage, right, if the refiners can't run?
Yes. Refineries just take longer to restart. They are a much more dangerous and complex system than oil wells. And the second part is we've had not a particularly constructive scenario for refining margins. Mm-hmm. So it may take a while, just because the cost of restarting may not justify you restarting right away until there is a draw in refining inventories that leads to higher margins. We saw that, for example, with Phillips 66 and their refineries in Louisiana when the latest hurricanes hit. So I think it will take a little bit longer. The good and bad news is we do have a refined product glut that we're working through. And so I don't expect that, except for in Texas itself, because of electricity issues, we won't have a shortage anytime soon. The global market is oversupplied. So there's plenty of product that can make its way to the U.S. In the coming weeks. But it will take a little bit longer to normalize refining supply. And that could lead to buildups in crude inventories and take a little bit of the wind off the sails of Brent and WTI.
Hey, Fernando, thank you, as always, for getting us a little bit smarter on the energy patch. Fernando Valle, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Energy Analyst.
a lot of smarter, I gotta say. All right, coming up on the program, Porsche IPO, what could be ahead for the car maker next?
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
All right, time to drive into what a Porsche IPO could actually look like. Our next guest writes that the carmaker's IPO is worth at least $130 billion to Volkswagen on Tesla or Ferrari metrics. That's a lot. Joining us now, Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Michael Dean. All right, Mike, tell us how you got to that number.
Yeah, so the valuation is up to $130 billion, and that's based on a discount to Ferrari. So Ferrari's trading on about 21 times 2021 EBITDA. Porsche's EBITDA margin is about 25-30% below that of Ferrari. So if you put a 30% discount on Ferrari's valuation to Porsche, that's where you get this sort of up to $130 billion.
All right. So what is Volkswagen thinking about here, Michael? Is an IPO something to is this something they're really thinking about seriously?
Yeah, so we've written about this for the past couple of years, and Volkswagen wants to double its market cap. And it's not getting recognition for its foray into electric vehicles. So one way that it could generate shareholder value is through an IPO or some of its most valuable assets. And Porsche certainly appears attractive from that point of view. One, as I mentioned, it has Ferrari-type margins, but also it's very well advanced in terms of electrification. And it's aiming to have 100%, almost 100% BEV market share by the end of the decade.
Really? Well, that's interesting. How did they get so far along? What did they do right?
Well, they launched the Taycan last year, so that's been fairly well received. And they sold 20,000 units last year, even given COVID lockdowns. They're going to have the Turismo, which is like an extended Taycan coming out this year. Then later this year, they're going to have a Macan BEV. So even by 2022, they could have about 30% BEV market share for their sales and aiming for 40% by 2025. So, yeah, they're very well advanced in that respect.
All right. So I just can't imagine Matt Miller, who drives his Porsche around Berlin, going electric with Porsche. What's the luxury performance market for electric vehicles? I guess you're telling us it's there.
Yeah. So, you know, Tesla pretty much had a free run for the past couple of years, and that's changing. So you've got many new models coming out, but Porsche was sort of at the front for Volkswagen. And, you know, acceleration is no longer really going to be sort of a luxury feature because all electric cars have quick acceleration. So it's all about reproducible power and recharging time. And certainly Porsche has overtaken Tesla in that respect.
So how does Tesla compete with that and / does it need to?
Well, you know, certainly Porsche hasn't caught up with Tesla on range, but that will come as sort of their batteries develop more. I think, you know, having a luxury name certainly helps Porsche. And, you know, Tesla, as I said, had a free reign. You know, it's going to be competing against the likes of Mercedes, you know, BMW, and more Porsches over the next 12 months. So it's going to be much more difficult for them to gain market share.
So, Michael, I mean, one of the funnest things I've seen a Ferrari or a Lamborghini, you know, drive down the road is the sound of it. Will those cars, when they're electric, will they still sound as cool as they do now?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if you've seen the Porsche Taycan on the road, and I've seen a few around where I live, it looks pretty good. It's got a sort of whine, but of course it doesn't have, you know, the same noise as a V8 engine. And that's one thing that Ferrari is struggling with because they realize they have to turn electric at some point. But again, you know, part of the whole feel of driving a Ferrari is, of course, the engine noise and everything that goes with that.
It is a little creepy, though, when you turn on an EV car for the first time and you're like, is it on? This happened to me. Is it not on? What button do I press?
Have like, I stalled it?
I was like, what, do I hit it? Like, that was definitely me the first time. So is it, what's the possibility of this happening? When will we see it, et cetera?
Well, in terms of Ferrari electric vehicle.
Oh, no, 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 sorry, Porsche IPO.
Oh, so they're talking about or speculation for the next 12 months or so. I mean, for Porsche, because it was a separate company 10 years ago, separation could be quite easy. Also, in terms of its relationship with Volkswagen, before Porsche was taken over by VW, it had arm's-length contracts on the Cayenne and the Panamera. So Porsche should be able to operate as an independent entity and still have quite a close relationship with Volkswagen. So possibly over the next 12 months, this could happen. I mean, if you look at European sales last year, they were down 25% in total for the market. But, you know, the luxury brands have been outperforming, and sort of the Porsche 911 is a good example. So in the previous sort of downturn, the last financial crisis, the 911 sales, they slumped by 45%.
Got it. All right, Michael, thank you so much. We appreciate that. Michael Dean, Senior Auto Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence.
All right, coming up on the program, Paul, are you still looking forward to hopping on a plane?
I absolutely am.
Where are you going?
Domestic first, then Europe.
Okay, so we're going to take a look at the road ahead for travel recovery in Europe. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, time to look at European travel recovery. Our next guest finds that hotel valuations can rest easy if recovery in the second half unfolds. Joining us now with that outlook, Bloomberg Intelligence industry analyst Conroy Gaynor. Conroy, I was moderating a panel this week for International Petroleum Week, and every single analyst was so pessimistic on jet fuel demand and when we're going to see real, true airline recovery. Do airlines and hotels go in the same direction, the same pace?
Well, I think the way we really have to look at this is exactly what the exposures are to. So we've done some work on this, and you know, we're really looking at to lead to the recovery is those, say, airlines and hotels are exposed to domestic demand. Still many question marks over whether, you know, we'll see a strong bounce back in international travel. So, you know, and I think this is a particularly important thing for Europe because, of course, a lot more of the travel relative to the US is relies on international cross-border travel, and that, of course, depends on, you know, what various governments allow, whether it be at the EU level, whether it be at the country level. So, you know, we really have to stay tuned for that. But certainly, I would say that, you know, there's strong evidence that we're seeing with the vaccine rollout that we can start to see, you know, be a bit more optimistic about whether at least some travel can resume and pick up in the second half of this year at the domestic level.
All right. So, Conroy, I mean, again, as I think about European travel, I just think it's by definition, you know, intra-country, it's international. It's not just people going from, you know, within the UK. It's really people going to the continent and back and forth. So what level of coordination do you expect that there will be in terms of reopening and allowing travel? What's the expectation?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, from the way I see it, the UK, for example, key market in Europe, is keen to help the aviation industry. It's been under immense pressure since the beginning of this crisis, and you know there will be, as you know, I'm sure there'll be, as we had before, the travel corridors. There'll be efforts put in place by various governments to try and get that cross-border travel moving again. And you know, when you also consider in Europe as well, there's many economies, be it, you know, Iberian countries, those towards the East Mediterranean countries, they rely on travel and tourism a lot for their economy, and especially they're going to want to see a GDP rebound. You know, we're talking economies that perhaps 20% of GDP is related to tourism. So they're going to be probably very incentivized to, you know, work out ways in which we can get people traveling again safely cross-border.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of talk about a travel passport, like you got a visa. I mean, a visa. Mm-hmm. You have, like, a vaccine, and then you put it on a piece of paper, and you can show it to the airlines, blah, blah, blah. Do you think we'll have the same kind of travel passport thing for hotels?
I mean, it's a very good question. And, you know, I guess the conversation doesn't just stop with hotels and you know, sort of various airports. It's also that question could be asked across the entire leisure industry. And I think that's one thing that different companies will have to consider. Now, the way we've been thinking about this is that, okay, so, you know, I think a lot of hospitality businesses are just keen to reopen. Of course, they want to do it safely. You know, on the one hand, by perhaps convincing people that they're safe to be in the venue because they're only letting vaccinated people, you're appealing more to those people. But then for the people that perhaps have their reasons for not getting vaccinated, and we'll obviously hope as many people get vaccinated as possible, but I'm not sure businesses will want to necessarily shut those people out. So I think there's some very difficult decisions and conversations that need to be had across the industry.
All right, Conroy, when you speak to the companies that you cover, the hotel companies, and when they just recently reported some results, how confident are they in that second half of the 2021 in terms of things opening up and bookings increasing?
Yeah, so I certainly think there is, maybe even since the beginning of the pandemic, there has been, you know, particularly Whitbread, which runs the UK leading Premier Inn chain. They were always very confident that we would see a bounce back towards the second half of this year. I think certainly more names like Intercontinental today have joined that as well. They're very confident. But you have to remember, again, those two names are very domestic orientated when we think of Premier Inn and, say, Holiday Inn Express and Holiday Inn, which is IHG's main chain. They are, you know, and IHG, by the way, has a lot of its exposure is actually the US, which is a domestic market. But they can be confident because, you know, they have this domestic customer demand. The ones that maybe, and it goes back to what I'm saying before, the ones that, you know, there's still a bit of doubt is on this sort of, you could say, this corporate group meetings market in the more upscale luxury hotels. You know, that's going to be a bit slower to come back. And some of that might not even come back at all. So, you know, Accor have forecast that, you know, that could be down 10% permanently. I've seen figures or forecasts even bigger than that. You know, some perhaps at the other may think that that's going to be cut in half on a recurring basis. So we have to see what happens. I mean, certainly, as we all know, the great experiment that we've tried with Zoom and other sort of remote meeting software, it can work. So some of there are certainly some meetings that could be replaced by that. I don't think we'll see all of this business travel taken away because some things are much better in person. So, you know, I do think there are some real, you know, question marks over that element, and I think it's reasonable to assume that there will be a permanent reduction in that, and the recovery certainly will be slower for that. As firms decide what to do. But at the same time, I think the domestic sort of leisure-orientated, limited service travel can come back in the second half of this year.
All right, thanks so much, Bloomberg Intelligence industry analyst Conroy Gaynor. Thank you very much.
Switching gears from European travel recovery to stimulus and how it could impact casual dining here in the United States. For more, let's bring in Bloomberg Intelligence senior restaurant analyst Michael Halen. So, Mike, thanks so much for joining us here. Just let us step back a little bit. Just give us a sense of how the restaurant industry kind of dealt with the pandemic. We're 12 months into it, and then we'll talk about what's to come here. But just give us a sense of how the restaurant business fair, we know it was really disrupted.
Yeah, and it was really bifurcated, right? So fast food names with their strong drive-through businesses and pretty strong delivery businesses did really well during the pandemic, while full-service restaurants were forced to close their dining rooms and kind of make a quick shift to doing more to-go sales. Right, but there was a big market share shift to the fast food names and away to full service.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and then we had the outdoor dining. That you know was kind of successful, I think. But now, obviously, we're stuck here in the winter months here. All right, so here we are. We're in the dead of winter. We're talking about some more fiscal stimulus here. What are you telling your institutional investor clients about how they should think about the restaurant category?
Yeah, I think everyone's kind of looking at it the same way in terms of fundamentals and how things are going to go. The question is, I guess to the degree that this market share shift might go back to full service, and also the timing of it. So, I think what everyone's looking at here is for, two things are going to happen. Quick service is going to start to lap very difficult comparisons. And then also as you get, better weather, less coronavirus cases, greater vaccinations, you expect full service, and then full service is going to be lapping very, very weak comparisons from last year. You'd expect, market share to shift back to full service, right? And what you're seeing is, it's being reflected into the stock prices over the last, couple months. We've seen casual dining restaurants vastly outperform quick service. So, that's the prevailing outlook. There's a couple of things that give us some pause here, though. First of all, casual dining names have been, rallying for 11 months with
quick service
restaurants.
And that's like an Applebee's, a Cheesecake Factory. Those are the casual ones?
Yes. Okay. Texas Roadhouse, Bloomin' Brands, Brinker, all of those chains. So they've actually been rallying for the last 11 months. They're actually being valued at higher multiples than quick service chains right now, despite the fact that in 2021, quick service chains are going to have higher sales than they did in 2019, and that's definitely not the case at casual dining. But casual dining is trading at 28 times 2021 EPS. This is versus the 15-year average of 15 times.
Wow.
Right? So they're pricing in a very strong recovery at CDR, which gives us a little pause. Like, I think what people are looking at are saying, 20% plus of independents are closing and may never reopen. I think they're also looking at it saying, restaurant advertising spending is way down. Chains have gone shifted more to technology, and they're doing more to one-to-one digital marketing.
All right. Well, just speaking for me, Michael, you can tell your companies that I will be out and about. Once I get my shot, I'm hopping on a plane. I don't care where it takes me, and I'll be going to restaurants. So, Mike, thanks so much for joining us here. That's Michael Halen. He's the senior analyst covering restaurants for Bloomberg Intelligence. That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.